Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is the story of a chip, the semiconductor chip that's in your new phone, car, game console, kitchen appliances, or at least it would be if there weren't a global shortage of these tiny tech wonders. So to better understand why you're having trouble buying that new car or phone right now, it's worth understanding how the chip comes into being in the first place under the best of circumstances. So let's hear that story. It begins in the ground with quartz, a mineral composed of silicon dioxide.
The silicon that comes out of the ground probably crisscrosses the world two or three times before it ends up in your phone.
That's Will Douglas Heaven, the senior editor at MIT Technology Review.
So the cool thing that I think, you know, a lot of people don't know, I certainly didn't know until I started looking into it, is that although computer chips are everywhere, I mean, there are few places in the world you'll be far from a computer chip, but every single one of those chips is made from this material, silicon. And there aren't actually that many places in the world where silicon is found in the ground pure enough to use to make computer chips. And there's one place in particular called Spruce Pine that's a town in North Carolina. There's a mine there where silica is found in sort of particularly pure quantities that had been chucked away for ages, because what people were actually after for centuries were gemstones and this stuff called mica, which is used in paint. And it was only when the semiconductor industry sort of took off in the 1980s that suddenly this quartz had new value and incredible value.
Spruce Pine, North Carolina. Population, about 2,200. Humans have, in fact, been mining here for more than 2,000 years, as evidenced by native tribes who dug down about 100 feet to pull mica from the ground millennia ago. The mica was later used in several of Thomas Edison's inventions, also in paint, as you heard. And the quartz extracted from the mines now is the purest in the world. So as Robin Townsend of the local Chamber of Commerce says, quote, if you have a computer, you have a little slice of Spruce Pine. Well, Will Douglas Heaven describes how they get the quartz out of the ground.
And then these quartz rocks are dug up with machines and explosives, and then they're put into a crusher, which crunches these rocks up into gravel. That gravel then goes to a processing plant where the quartz gravel is ground down further into a fine sand.
The sand is processed to separate out and refine the silicon.
And it's then bagged up and sent off to the next stage.
That next stage is where the pure elemental silicon starts looking like something more familiar. And there are only a few facilities around the world where this happens, such as Sumco in Japan or Siltronic AG in Germany.
The powder is then melted down into cylinders. So imagine this sort of a salami. And then we're getting close to what people would recognize as chips. This cylinder is then finely sliced into wafers, like you're chopping a cucumber or a salami. So you end up with these round, thin discs.
And then those round, thin discs are shipped off again to a factory that makes the actual chips. Now, this could be in Austin, Texas, or Incheon, South Korea, or Hsinchu, Taiwan, or even Hillsboro, Oregon.
Once you get actually to making chips themselves, which get printed onto this thin disc, this is a extremely delicate. The conditions need to be sort of like lab conditions. You see pictures of workers in these chip factories wearing what look like hazmat suits. You can't have any kind of contamination, no dust, anything like that, because that will completely wreck the minute circuitry on the chips that you're trying to print on. So any kind of little bit of dust that got into that would completely ruin it, which is kind of cool. We've gone from the messy quarry with the dust and the explosions all the way now to sort of super, super clean labs, which is where the chips get made.
And as the chips get made in those super, super clean rooms, new materials are printed on to the wafers. Now, these materials have their own complex supply chains as well. Things like getting copper, which might come from Chile, or aluminum, which might come from China, or boron, which might come from Turkey. All of that has to come together in these manufacturing facilities that print the chips. Well, then the chips are sent to yet another factory for testing, where microscopic probes assess whether the chip is working as required. They're cut apart and put into packages, adding even more materials to the process. And then they are shipped off again to other factories, where they are finally put onto circuit boards. And those factories, though, are usually not in the same places as where the chip makes its final stop, that assembly line into cars, computers, phones, appliances, etc. So even in that very simplified outline of the story of a chip, we begin to see how complex the supply chains are around this one product, this one ubiquitous product in modern life. So what is causing the shortage of all the chips that we need? Well, joining us now is Dr. Willie Shi. He's the Robert and Jane Sizek Professor of Management Practice in Business Administration at Harvard Business School. Professor Shi, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Meghna, and thank you for having me.
So, yes, a very simplified version of the story of a chip here. Can you help us understand if we should be looking even further upstream in the development process to begin to understand sort of why we're seeing this chip shortage worldwide right now?
Well, Meghna, the chip shortage has, I would say in the beginning, it had some relatively simple causes, which have then compounded over time. Now, as you pointed out, the manufacturing process for these chips is very complex. And in these factories, like you mentioned in Hillsboro, Oregon, or Hsinchu, Taiwan, you know, those factories, in their super clean rooms, those manufacturing processes have about 700 steps, many of which, as you pointed out, are dependent on other things. Now, the chip designs, by the way, also come from specialist firms who do the design. So it's even more complicated than that. And then inside one of these factories, which are called fabs, you have these tools. And the tools, sometimes they cost a couple million dollars. The most expensive ones cost around $150 million each. And each one of those tools has its own supply chain. So you have a very complex global network of firms all over the world who participate in these supply chains. And in normal times, they work remarkably well. But once you start having some disruptions, as we saw at the beginning of the pandemic, then things start to go awry.
Yeah. So is the pandemic the unifying force in the disruptions that we're seeing? Because from what you've described, the only thing right now that I can think of that's touching all of those, you know, many thousands of points along these various supply chains that come together to make these little semiconductors is the pandemic. Is it labor shortages worldwide from everywhere from, you know, the designers of the chips to the miners in the various countries that are pulling these elements out of the ground? Is that what's going on here?
Well, Meghna, at the beginning of the pandemic, I would say demand shifts were the biggest drivers of disruption. Mm. So on the one hand, what we saw is much more demand for things like notebook computers or Peloton bikes and exercise machines. Those all have computer chips in them as well. Or home appliances like freezers, and those all have computer chips in them as well. So we saw a surge in demand of certain types of products. And because these electronic chips are used pervasively, it was across many segments. At the same time, and this is where we first saw the big shortages, the auto industry saw a collapse in demand. And in the U.S., we tend to forget that the U.S. is not the world's largest auto market. Rather, China is the world's largest auto market. And so going into 2020, we had this very interesting circumstance. Now, China's peak passenger vehicle demand was actually in 2017. And then in 2018, it dropped a little bit. 2019, it dropped a little bit. And then going into January 2020, the outlook for the China car market was kind of pessimistic for a little bit more shrinkage. And that was even before the pandemic hit. Then the pandemic hits. And in February of 2020, vehicle sales in China dropped 82%. Huh. Okay, now we saw a kind of delayed reaction in Europe. In Europe, in March, they fell 46%, and in April, they fell around 80%. In the U.S., it wasn't until April we saw about a 52% drop in vehicle sales. Okay, now if you're an automaker, and you know, we have some of the Detroit automakers whose memories of filing for bankruptcy are still relatively fresh. Back in those times, they were thinking, we don't want to run out of cash. We don't want to file for bankruptcy again. So they cut back on their incoming material orders, which, by the way, includes all of these chips that we're talking about. You know, so as they cut back on those orders, we saw this demand surge in work from home, computer gaming consoles, anything that uses electronics, right? So, you know, the factories that make these chips shifted their capacity to serve some of these other markets. By the time the automakers realized, which was late summer of 2020, that demand was coming back, and they come back and say, okay, we want to order all those chips now, guess what? The factories were filled with orders for other chips.
Uh-huh.
At the same time, we were sanctioning or threatening sanctions against a number of Chinese companies. This was also during the summer of 2020. And so they were, quite frankly, panic-stricken about running out of chips and therefore going out of business. So they laid huge orders on these factories at the same time. So they were stockpiling a lot of chips. So what we saw is this abnormal demand shift, which then caught the automakers short.
I see. So Dr. Xi, just stand by for a second, because this is absolutely fascinating. And I want to touch on other parts of the supply chain when we come back from a break. But listeners, today we're trying to get a handle on what's causing that chip shortage that you've been hearing a lot about or even experiencing in your own life, but really using that as the lens through which, or the keyhole through which, to ask a bigger question about the resilience of supply chains around the world. So hop on Facebook or Twitter. We're at On Point Radio, and ask us your questions of what you want to know about supply chains. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about supply chain woes around the world and what the pandemic and what it's revealed has shown us about how maybe we, not just here in the United States, but around the world, can make supply chains more resilient. And we're talking about chips in particular today as the way into that question. And I'm joined by Dr. Willie Xi. He is a professor of management practice in business administration at Harvard Business School. And Professor Xi, if we can, let me just hear from some listeners who have been sharing their stories of how hard it has been recently to get electronics or other goods. Here's Diana from Spokane, Washington.
My car basically died this week. It has a repair that it's just not worth it to me. I need to get a new car. I went down to the dealer I've used before, and they had no cars of what I wanted, but they had a 2-year-old model, and they would be willing to sell it to me for $3,000 over the original MSRP price. And it had only, 20,000 miles on it. So a used car for $3,000 over the original price.
Oh, Diana, gosh, feeling your pain. Here's Jackie from Connecticut.
I was in the market for almost a year to buy a new smartphone, a Samsung, and there just was nothing available. I went to different stores and they had nothing, only the display model, which obviously they weren't going to sell. Ended up that my husband found one online. I obviously bought the phone thanks to my husband. And this was really the first time I've encountered such a shortage for pretty much a basic consumer item.
Just a couple of the many calls that we got from folks sharing their supply chain woes with us. But Professor Shi, we talked about, you described the demand surge and demand collapse that happened as a result of the pandemic. I want to come back to that in a second. But I'd love for you to help us understand other sort of pressure points, if I could put it that way, in the chip supply chain. You know, for example, I was hearing about how or been reading about how extreme weather or even fires at particular facilities can cause really profound downstream effects with chip availability. Can you help us understand that?
That's right, Magna. And, you know, so we had this first phase driven by the pandemic, but then starting with last fall, we had a series of unfortunate incidents. One was a fire at the Asahi Akase Microsystems fab in Japan, and they specialize in what are called digital to analog and analog to digital converters, very important for audio. Then we had in Texas earlier this year, the week of February 15th, we had the cold weather, which forced Samsung to shut down its fab, and it's a large fab in Austin, Texas, and NXP, which is a large manufacturer of chips for cars, had to shut down. And when you shut down because you don't have electricity, it takes you a month to bring those facilities back up. And then also in March, there was a fire at the Renesas fab in Naka, Japan. I've been to that fab. They were taken offline by the earthquake and tsunami back in 2011, 10 years previous. Now, between Renesas and NXP, they're large suppliers of chips for automobiles. And so that's why you hear of all these automotive shortages. We had the demand shift and the sudden shifts there, aggravated by key suppliers going offline. And if you're a manufacturer, Jackie was talking about her smartphone, okay, and you think about a smartphone typically might have 4,000 parts. When you're manufacturing something like that, the manufacturers have a term clear to build. When do I have all the parts that I need, all 4,000 of them in the case perhaps of that smartphone? Because if I don't have one, I can't build the product. And that was really the problem. So you have these spot shortages aggravated by all of these unfortunate incidents. And that really brought us to, I'd say, maybe the first half of this year. Okay. And then we really entered a new phase, which had been developing for some time, where people started hoarding parts. Okay. And that's kind of the situation we have right now.
When you say people started hoarding parts, meaning what? The companies that are making these devices, who was doing the hoarding?
Well, and companies who are making these devices will never admit they're doing this. Okay, but they're ordering more parts than they need because they don't want to be caught short. If you have parts and your competitor doesn't have parts, then you'll gain market share on that, right? So everybody is very insecure about their ability to procure all these chips. So, and like I say, nobody will admit this. Is there a lot of double ordering going on? You have to believe that. And when you have people ordering more than they immediately need because they want to make sure they have them, as you can imagine, that just puts even more stress on a supply chain that is already stretched to the limit.
Wow. Okay. So then there's one more point on the overall supply chain that I want to talk about in a little bit of detail of the thousands of points. Again, I am absolutely agog by how complex this is and how it actually works in normal circumstances. It's amazing. Quite a tribute to human ingenuity, but we're talking about how it's not working now. So what about the consumer endpoint here? And specifically in that you know, the transportation and shipping, because we're seeing, what is it, record high prices for shipping containers now, $20,000 of the cost of a container to come from China to the west coast of the United States, and per container, right? And then also for listeners who hear us in Los Angeles, I'm sure they're very aware of like ships being backed up in the port of Los Angeles or Long Beach. So the Washington Post reported that it seems as if there's kind of a system-wide weakness in delivery from shipping to rail to trucks in the United States. Is that also part of this story?
Well, Meghna, that's a big part of the story as well. If you look at ocean-borne cargo, and ocean-borne cargo, particularly from Asia to the U.S. or Asia to Europe, makes up about 95% of traded goods, and the remaining 5% moves by air. Now, most semiconductor chips move by air because they're relatively high value. By the way, disruptions in air are another story, but let's stick with the ocean part. That $20,000 to move a container from East Asia to, say, Los Angeles, Long Beach, that used to be $1,800. And $20,000 today is if you can even book the space. One of the things that has happened is we had such a huge wave of imports as lockdowns started to loosen up the middle part of last year. Starting in August of 2020, we had a surge of imports like this country has never seen. And that surge has been continuing. Typically, what you see is a peak season in September, October, early November, when everybody's trying to get their holiday goods into stores in the U.S., especially from Asia. Well, that peak season in 2020 started in August, and it hasn't ended. And to this day, it hasn't ended. And some people are saying that peak season is going to keep going until perhaps 2023, Lunar New Year, because we have such a wave of imports. And the wave of imports has really overstretched the entire logistics system. It has overextended the ports and the terminal operators in Los Angeles and Long Beach. They can't handle that much traffic. Last week, I think the peak was 62 ships waiting offshore.
Wow.
And then once they do get into one of the terminals and they unload, there's a shortage of trailers that you put those boxes on. So you can't bring them to the distribution centers, which when you get to the distribution centers, they're clogged and they're suffering from labor shortages. So then you can't unload the containers. Meanwhile, if you are in the Midwest, there are a lot of large distribution centers around Texas, around the Dallas area, around the Chicago area. And those come via intermodal train. So, for example, from Los Angeles and Long Beach, you might use Union Pacific or BNSF to bring those containers to, in the case of Union Pacific, they have a big hub called Global 4 in Joliet, Illinois, where all the containers go. They had to close that yard several weeks ago, just because there was so much congestion, the truckers couldn't get in to pick the boxes up. So they had to stop accepting any traffic from the West Coast for a while so they could clear the backlog. So what we have is the entire supply chain from the factory to our retail stores and distribution centers is clogged. And as that gets worse, things get even worse. So, for example, when you have all those ships, 62 ships waiting off the port of Los Angeles, Long Beach, waiting to unload, that means they don't get back to Asia.
Yeah.
Rather, they're waiting here. And so then container shipping schedule reliability, you know, we often think about schedule reliability with air travel in the days when we used to fly around. Container shipping reliability every week for the last couple of months hits a new all-time low, right? So the schedule reliability is just completely out the window.
Wow.
And then once in a while, you have things, you know, so these supply chain troubles are really evolving right now. Mm. So back over the last couple of weeks, we had the Yantan container terminal in Shenzhen was closed for a while because of a COVID outbreak. Ningbo was closed. We're seeing a lot of troubles in Vietnam right now. So all of those things just pile additional troubles on top of the troubles we've already seen. And that's why most of the people in the industry are rather pessimistic about how long it's going to take to clean this up.
Yeah. Well, so these outcomes all have a series of decisions that were made a long time ago that have, in a sense, led to the moment that we're in now. You know, beyond the pandemic itself. Again, I just note that kudos to the Washington Post. They did a very deep dive on this and came to the conclusion that what we're also seeing is the effects of investment shortfalls, they say, at some of the key ports in the United States, labor cuts across the various nodes of the logistics industry, and they say a failure of key players in logistics and shipping to collaborate with each other. And we'll come back to that because we're going to talk about solutions here in just a second. But obviously, this is all having cumulatively an impact, not just on consumers, but on business people, large and small here in the United States. And so, for example, here's what we heard from Jay, who lives in Los Angeles.
Things have just been terrible as far as being able to get product. And we're a small business here in Los Angeles, and we're trying to survive and see what happens. The way it's going, it seems like there's a delay in getting product out of the port. So it's unfortunate because it's killing a lot of small businesses out here.
Okay, Professor Shi, so we've talked, you basically described, to paraphrase what you said a minute ago, that there is kind of almost a total ripple effect across the entire supply chain. You know, we're talking about chips at this hour, but for many goods, from the very start of the supply chain, insofar as even pulling things out of the ground or designing them, to the fabs in which they're put together, to the final factories which the end product is made, to the logistics and distribution systems, the global sea, air, and ground system to get these things to stores and to people. Now, if we're having that many different kinds of failures across such a complex system, in a sense, is this one of those black swan events that's really not going to happen all that often, or is there something different going on here?
Well, Meghna, I'm not sure I would call it a black swan event. Certainly, we've had our share of unusual disruptions. But I think one of the things that is happening right now, if you talk to shipping executives around the world, they say a lot of this is driven by the American consumer. We have put a lot of stimulus money into the economy, and a lot of people are buying things. And it is that wave of imports, that surge in imports, which is now overtaxing the logistics and distribution infrastructure globally. Now, you could argue that perhaps we have underinvested. I would agree with some of that because we haven't invested in the port capacity and the distribution center capacity and that logistics capacity. But a lot of that is because historically it hasn't been that profitable a business. And so people have been very focused on cost. If you look at the container shipping business, until the last 2 years, it was very tough for those companies to make money. They tended to go through boom and bust cycles where they would buy new, larger ships that were more efficient so they could get their costs down. And then when they added all that capacity, their prices would go down and they'd be losing money. It's only been in the last year and a half that they've been making a lot of money. So there is economics behind this as well. We are definitely behind on our infrastructure investments in the U.S., especially as it regards to port infrastructure and the ability to handle the volumes of imports that we are trying to bring in. It does make me wonder, though, because one of the reasons we offshore that manufacturing to East Asia is because it's less expensive mm-hmm. there. But now with all this transport cost, you have to wonder, why doesn't it come back?
Well, we're going to explore that question when we come back. We are talking this hour about global supply chains and how they have been pushed to the limit, even broken down in the past year and a half, and what opportunities there may be to improve them. Professor Willie Shi is with us. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're joined by Professor Willie Shi, who is a professor of management practice in business administration at Harvard Business School. And he's talking us through why we're seeing global supply chain woes. You've probably felt it if you're trying to buy a new phone or a car or some appliances and have had to wait months or maybe even a year to receive those products, or if you're trying to sell them as well, how that's having an impact on your business. But we're taking the opportunity to ask whether this, in a sense, stress test, this global stress test of supply chains is providing us insight on how to improve them in the future. So let's talk for a second about how this chip shortage, the semiconductor chip shortage, is having an impact on businesses big and small. Well, Wyatt Olson is the CEO of Ultraviolet Audio Video in Santa Barbara, California. They install custom lighting, sound systems, and audiovisual equipment in homes and offices. So, of course, they work with a lot of products that depend on chips.
The chip shortage has made it so that, you know, equipment that we've sold, contracts that we've agreed to fulfill, we can't get these particular components because they're not available. And when they are available, they take, you know, at least 15 to 20 times longer than they typically do. So the issue that we're experiencing is we can't fulfill obligations that we've made in the past. And if we can, we're massively late on them.
And Olson says that's hurting his business. He cannot collect final payment until a job is complete.
And you can't complete, you know, a minimum of 20% of them, then you can't proceed to your next project because you haven't finished your previous ones.
So just how long are the delays Olson is facing?
I have orders right now that I placed a week ago, and we're not actually going to get the gear until, I'm looking at it right now, August of 2022.
In the meantime, he says he has to figure out workarounds for how to do his job in new ways.
I'm going to give you an example of internet equipment. Okay, we use a brand quite frequently called Ubiquiti Networks. Typically, we would actually purchase Ubiquiti through a distributor. Ubiquiti doesn't deal directly with businesses of our size. They want somebody slightly larger. The issue with this, they have not been shipping to distributors because they make more money off, you know, selling directly to the consumers. So what we're doing is we're going directly on their website, just like any other consumer could, and purchasing this equipment. But the issue is with this equipment is there's usually limits on how much you can actually buy per account. So we've had to create so many different email addresses just to purchase enough of this equipment where we can keep our business operational. So we've had to diversify how we get items. We can't just rely on a particular manufacturer or a particular distributor. We have to rely on many, and oftentimes buying them from just the retail sector and just storing it as much of it as we possibly can.
It's got to drive a business person nuts having to make 150 different junk email addresses just to order the components that you need to do your business. And Wyatt Olson told us they've also bought things off of eBay, for example. But in the end, of course, none of these workarounds are truly sustainable.
So here's the thing. With a business like ours, buying large amounts of inventory, like I said, we're doing just to make sure that we can stay on top of things and get our jobs done, is actually a dangerous move. Dealing with technology is like buying perishable inventory at a grocery store. Things in our world have a short shelf life. We have about 9 months to sell something before the next generation is out. So you don't want to be sitting on too much inventory. So ultimately, what I'm hoping for is some sort of long-term stability when the world gets back to normal and we can continue operating, you know, where we could place an order and have our gear a week later and then do our job the week after that.
That's Wyatt Olson, CEO of Ultraviolet Audio Video in Santa Barbara, California. Professor Shi, Wyatt, like the rest of us, are hoping for a return to normal fairly soon. But regarding these supply chain woes, can we prognosticate about when things might stabilize?
Well, I think Mr. Olson highlights a real difficulty faced by small businesses and large businesses as well. I mentioned earlier that there's a widespread belief that people are ordering more than they need, and that's actually aggravating some of the difficulties. I saw some figures from Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, which is the largest semiconductor foundry in the world. And their revenue growth is going to be 20% this year. And that was $45 billion in revenue last year. So 20% on $45 billion is a lot. They had earlier said this year that for the full year, they are going to produce 60% more microcontrollers than they did in the past. So the question is, where are all those parts going? And how does this movie play out in the next scene? I worry about that because these things tend not to have a very happy ending, right? Because eventually, as Mr. Olson points out, these semiconductor chips, they have a relatively short life because newer models come out and the old ones become obsolete, right? There's going to come a point when people are going to say, how come we have so much inventory? How come we have so much cash tied up in inventory? And then this thing will correct. And when it does, it won't be pretty. I wrote about, you know, toilet paper hoarding back in February, March 2020, that made me famous. People think I'm the world's expert on toilet paper. And I really don't know anything about toilet paper. I wrote this piece because I said, you don't need to know anything about toilet paper to figure out what the supply chain looks like because demand is flat. It's not like there's some seasons that use more toilet paper. Right. And so what I said then is that, you know, all that hoarding will eventually have an unhappy outcome when people can't store any more in their pantry or in their house, and they'll start burning off that inventory and stop buying it. And sure enough, earlier this year, we saw that with people buying less, and the big toilet paper manufacturers saw big sales declines. Okay, now it's starting to wrap around again because people are starting to buy more again, and everybody's ramping up production. And that will happen in a lot of areas. In supply chains, we call this the bullwhip effect because it looks like if you're holding a bullwhip, you see these oscillations going out to the end of the chain. So demand goes up, supply goes up to meet it. All of a sudden I have excess supply, then, you know, I have to work that off and we go up and down. And this happens all the time in supply chains. And I'm guessing we're going to see it here as well.
Okay. So this then is, funnily enough, through the example of toilet paper, is really getting to the heart of things. Because we could look at any one particular part of these very complex supply chains and come up with concrete solutions on how to improve them. But overall, You know, what I'm hearing is when we talk about companies not wanting to have cash tied up in inventory, for example, and then the bullwhip effect, as you talked about, how things just like really can spiral quickly through supply chains when we have demand drops or demand surges. What I'm hearing here is the downside of having these very, very sophisticated global supply chains that are built for maximum efficiency. So maximum efficiency, though, it doesn't seem to leave a lot of room for, unexpected surges or drops or these weather events, pandemics, things like that. So do we need to start thinking a little bit about or a lot about how much efficiency would we like to exchange to gain resilience instead? Like, do we have to actually build in a little inefficiency into our systems to have an overall more resilient supply chain?
Meghna, I think that's a great question. And we saw that in PPE, you know, protective mm-hmm. gear that we needed for the pandemic. And things like masks, there were all of these domestic firms who responded to the call to make PPE. There's a local one here in Massachusetts that I took a good look at who responded to the calls from state and local government and businesses to make PPE. And then they did. They invested a lot of money and started a mask making line. And as soon as they were done, of course, the market was flooded by imports from China, so then they couldn't sell their products. Okay, so the trade-off you describe between efficiency and resiliency requires us to maybe spend more on our products.
Right.
And I think that's really the core question. Am I willing, when I go into a store and I'm looking at, say, N95 masks, am I willing to pay more from a supplier that will give our country more resiliency as opposed to immediately going to the lowest price? That's a tough question, and I don't think we'll like the answer.
Well, there's the am I as a consumer being willing to pay more, and then, you know, or am I as the corporation willing to take a small slice out of the profits? Out of my profit margin to achieve more resiliency over efficiency. That too is part of the question, isn't it?
Well, I think so. And I think there's a really terrific example out there in the auto industry. We see that until recently, Toyota has done much better than many of the Detroit automakers. And if you look at how they put together their supply chains, they take a much more strategic view of their suppliers, view them as partners, work with them to ensure supply continuity, as opposed to, if I may say, a manufacturer who is very transactional, focused mostly on price. Mm-hmm. Now, what we have heard over the last couple of months is some of the more transactionally focused automakers talking about a new era of strategic partnerships with their suppliers. So maybe things will change because they have certainly been burned by shortages in this pandemic.
You know, Professor Xi, when I did my MBA ages ago, one of my favorite little case studies, or not even case studies, just like a theoretical question that was asked in my operations class was the following. It's kind of an interesting way to think about this. My professor, she asked us, if you were to staff a 911 call center, how many people would you staff it with when you know the average number of calls per day is like 10? And obviously, the point of the question is, do you staff for 10 calls or do you staff for the day that you don't know is coming, but well, that you know is coming, but you don't know when there's like, say, a major fire and you get 5,000 calls, right? So that's an extreme example of how you have to think about that efficiency versus resiliency trade-off. And perhaps this is sort of, I wouldn't call it necessarily a 911 situation, but it is that it, we are experiencing that stress test, are we not, for global supply chains? So where would you actually look to see where improvements are made? Is there a role for government here or not?
Well, I think what you highlight is the penalty that financial markets place on manufacturers for inefficient utilization of assets. So just as in your 911 example, I pointed this out in the toilet paper situation. I said, you know, if you are a toilet paper manufacturer and you know demand is stable, you are going to run your factories at around 90 plus percent utilization. So you don't have a lot of slack capacity. Because if you were running them at 50% utilization, your CFO, if he didn't do something, he'd probably get fired. Okay. But your CFO would be all over the manufacturing team saying, how come my utilization is so low? Right. Because if I have high utilization, I spread my costs over more volume. Right. So people don't like inefficient use of capital, inefficient use of factories. What we saw in a lot of the talk about having domestic supply chains for PPE is we want them here for an emergency, okay, but we're not willing to pay the premium to have them here when we don't have an emergency. Right. And remember, domestic suppliers, by virtue of paying higher labor costs and higher other costs, they're higher cost producers. And you can't have one of those be a swing producer, only producing in emergencies, because they can't stay in business when you do that. So it is a dilemma. It's a very hard problem.
Well, some countries look to government to actually serve as that buffer during these, you know, high stress moments in a supply chain. You've written about this. We've just got about a minute left to go. You know, when they look to government to provide subsidies to carry these companies through the periods of very, very unstable demand. Is that something that should be further explored?
Well, I'm not a fan of subsidies, but what governments can do is they can provide regular purchases to domestic suppliers so that those guys can stay in business and then be around for the next crisis when we need them. In other words, the government can be a stable buyer who may be willing to pay a premium to ensure that kind of resiliency.
Well, in the last 30 seconds that we have, Professor Xi, really, I think people just really want to know. You were a little uncertain beforehand or unwilling, but how long is that bullwhip effect going to last? I mean, we've got the holiday season, the winter holiday season coming up on us. Is this going to be something that people are going to face into 2022 or beyond?
Well, I think we're going to see it into 2022 and maybe beyond. It's going to vary by sector. We've painted a very complex picture, and what you see is some areas are better off than others, right? So, for example, apparel and footwear are really suffering right now because of COVID outbreaks in Vietnam and Malaysia, right? So it's going to depend. It's going to be a tough holiday season for retailers, but eventually this is going to snap back.
Well, Willie Xi is a professor of management practice in business administration at Harvard Business School. Professor Xi, thank you so much for walking us through this fascinating web of global supply chains. It was really a terrific journey. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.